rise.
All right, good morning, everyone. Please be seated. All right, we are here today in the case of Northwest Territorial Mint, LLC. This is the continued hearing on the applications for compensation and reimbursement of expenses filed by the Chapter 11 trustee, K&L Gates, Cascade Capital, and Miller, Nash, Graham, and Dunn. At the last hearing, I had asked the parties to provide the court some additional information, and that has been done. Again, I always appreciate the copies for chambers that K&L Gates has provided of the paperwork. I just have a few final questions on a few matters and a couple of requests.
You have appearances, please.
Oh, yes, let's have appearances for the record. We'll start with Mr. Guerin's side of the table.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Guerin, K&L Gates, for the Chapter 11 trustee, Mark Calvert, who's with me at the table. My colleague Dave New is also here.
All right, good morning to you all. Good
morning, Your Honor. Mark Northrup, Miller, Nash, Graham, and Dunn, counsel for the committee.
Good morning to you as well, Mr. Northrup. All right. So we have that. Let me start with just a few questions, and I'll start with Mr. Calvert or Mr. Guerin. Either one of you can answer, though these are primarily initially directed at Mr. Calvert. I have the subpoenas that you sent to me in camera. I am going to ask that you file them under seal. I do have some questions about them. It appears at least one subpoena that the FBI was asking for reports and draft reports that Cascade Capital had prepared regarding insolvency, bullion transaction analysis, reasonably equivalent value, owner's draw analysis. Were those documents provided to the FBI?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, isn't this work product that belongs to the estate? I guess this is more to Mr. Guerin. Why would that be evidence that would be admissible in any trial that the U.S. attorneys could use against anyone? And therefore, why is the FBI asking for work that is being done for the estate, if you know?
Your Honor, I wouldn't know. I mean, what I can tell you is that the FBI had an ongoing investigation, and I think that the materials they were asking us for were in furtherance of that investigation. Whether it was admissible evidence or not, I wouldn't speak to that. I think that would be up to the U.S. Attorney's Office. So I couldn't tell you what their motivations were. All I can tell you is they asked us, they delivered the subpoenas to us, and I know we produced in response to those subpoenas, and Mr. Calvert would know more about the details of what was actually produced.
So how would the FBI know that those reports exist? Maybe Mr. Calvert, did you tell the FBI you were preparing these reports?
Your Honor, the FBI would sometimes hand deliver those subpoenas, and they would ask questions. So I would answer those questions as to what we were doing, what reports we were finishing, what analysis we had done. And once that had happened, they would go back and then sometimes come back in a very short time after and give me an additional subpoena.
And they would ask for, I mean, this is work product that I haven't fly-specked the bills, but I'm fairly certain that all the time devoted to preparing these reports, the professionals are being asked to be compensated for. Why should that work be shared with somebody else without them at least paying for part of it?
Your Honor, I think that, is there a way for us to get compensated from the United States government for some of the work that was produced? We haven't really looked at that. I think these reports, these materials are actually being prepared for independent purposes. The Medallic trial, for example, insolvency was an issue there. Reasonably equivalent value was an issue there. For purposes of looking at whether we'd be successful in pursuing our substantive consolidation case. Bear with me one second.
Sure.
Mr. Calvert points out, Your Honor, that one of the additional tasks that he was pursuing was his investigation of fraud and his investigation of missing inventory whether there'd be avenues to pursue recovery of missing inventory, that kind of thing. And so these were independent purposes for pursuing these tasks. Now, as to whether there's a way to get compensated from the government, I've not thought about that. Is there an avenue for us to go? I'm dubious that the government's going to honor any claim that we might make to, you know, to the contributions that were made by their access to these reports, but it's something we could look at.
Well, I think you're right, Mr. Guerin, and I ask that somewhat rhetorically in that I don't think the FBI is going to pay for it. Here's the problem I have is that I've not seen the discovery requests that were issued by your various parties in the litigation you had with Mr. Hansen and Ms. Erdman, but I would bet a fair amount of money that there were some requests that you responded to, you're not going to produce work product. And this is work product. Why is a state sharing its work product with anybody, even the FBI? Isn't the proper response is that's our work product? You can't use it for evidence anyway. If you want to use Mr. Calvert as an expert, you can do that, but that's going to be on his own time, or you're going to have to let me know. The problem I have here, and this is, I think, very evident, is that it appears Mr. Calvert was acting as a pseudo-FBI agent, that he was working for the FBI, and this subpoena confirms that he was willingly turning over his work product to the FBI. And so it's not just that the FBI is gaining the benefit at the estate, gaining some benefits at the expense of the creditors, but it calls into question where Mr. Calvert's loyalties lie. And I'm very concerned about this. I've said many times that the U.S. attorney and the FBI issue subpoenas. It is a necessary cost for the estate to comply with subpoenas. That is perfectly fine. It's not a necessary expense for the trustee to create memoranda, work product, solvency analysis for the FBI to use, because it served no purpose having maybe I'm wrong. Yes, I've always wondered, what was the purpose in having Mr. Hansen be indicted? Was that perceived to be a benefit to the estate?
Your Honor, Mr. Calvert was not working as an agent for the FBI. No. Mr. Calvert was independently doing his own analysis, his own investigation as a trustee in the case, preparing solvency analysis for purposes of litigation in the case that were independent of any work that the FBI was doing. The FBI was requesting information, was issuing subpoenas, demanding production of information, and the trustee responded to those informational requests. And that was a one-way street, frankly, from the FBI. The FBI gave no information to Mr. Calvert and did not further any of his investigative efforts.
Right.
It was only them demanding and insisting on the production of information from Mr. Calvert. So the issue today is whether these are compensable expenses, actual and necessary expenditures on behalf of the estate. And Mr. Calvert prepared these analyses for purposes that were of benefit to the estate. They were prepared for litigation purposes and in pursuit of his investigation of fraud that had occurred on the debtor's watch prior to the filing of the bankruptcy case.
I see all that, and you know, insolvency clearly is an analysis that you do pretty routinely in a Chapter 11 case. These all appear to be reports that were usable, or at least designed to be usable, in connection with this case for the benefit of creditors. I guess my question, maybe it's more toward you. Shouldn't you have responded, this is work product, you don't get it. It's not evidence, you can't use it. You're not going to get our work product. Why are you sharing the work? Because, by the way, you've now blown the ability to object to someone's request for work product. And if you objected and refused to produce work product to say Medallic in your litigation, you were wrong, because you've given it away. That's the harm to the estate, is you harm yourself in future litigation by, if you're honestly responding to requests that you've got work product, if you've shared it with somebody else, it's no longer protected.
Your Honor, that may or may not be true. What I'll tell you is I believe that the reports actually ultimately were produced in the Medallic litigation in advance. We were getting ready for trial, as you will recall. We were not that far away from going to trial, and we had designated experts and produced reports in that litigation before Medallic actually folded up and voluntarily non-suited their case.
Right.
I think these things are, frankly, they are not relevant to what we are talking about today, which is whether these fees and expenses that were incurred in connection with these reports are actual and necessary expenses of the estate. I'm not sure why we are discussing questions about whether what we should have done in response to the FBI subpoena in this context.
Well, see, Mr. Guerin, it's beyond just looking at the hours and time spent. I mean, I thought I've made that clear up to now, that I have serious concerns about the conduct of various parties that will result in reductions of compensation beyond just what may have been overbilling or too high. That's what this is going to. And whether there's been conduct that was detrimental to the estate or not in the interest of the estate will result in some reductions and perhaps significant reductions. Clearly, my questions have not just been aimed at whether too much time was spent on something. That's what these last three hearings have been about, because I could have just gone through the line by line and said, well, that was too much time spent on a motion. That's not what this is about. Some serious concerns.
Your Honor, if I may.
This is one of them that's been raised, that Mr. Calvert's goal, even at the 341 meeting, talking about how the FBI is coming after Mr. Hansen, has been more aimed at getting Ross, and his animus toward Mr. Hansen has been clear, and in the view of the court has clouded his vision in how he managed this case. And this disclosure, freely disclosing his reports, drafts of reports, rather than pushing back and saying, no, that belongs to the estate, you don't get it, it's not evidence, I'm not gonna help you make your case, is just further support to the allegations that have been made by others, and the court believes to be credible. And so that's not a question, that's a statement. And so no one is surprised when I write my decision. Let me ask you more of a nuts and bolts question. Who paid for the copying of all these documents?
I wouldn't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I would have to go back and look at that. I don't know.
I mean, there are a number of subpoenas and lots of documents. I mean, this comes back to the expense question is, that copying cost should not be borne by the estate. Is it being requested to be compensated or reimbursed? Does Mr. Calvert, do you know?
Your Honor, if I may address your comments in whole, not in part.
Well, can you answer that? And then, yes, you can address all the comments. But who paid? Is the copying bill in the bills I have for the FBI documents provided to the FBI?
I don't charge for copying. So if it's done at my office, it would not have had a charge.
Well, whose office?
Some items were provided electronically.
Okay.
So they were downloaded and provided electronically versus actually copied and printed out. So a lot of information was electronically provided and not copied and provided.
Okay,
but if it was copied, it would have been done at the Mint, yes.
And at the Mint, what I'm getting at is I've got lots of copying charges, primarily K&L Gates copying charges that are not allocated to anything.
I will say that most of the stuff provided to the FBI came from my offices, from me or from the Mint electronically,
okay,
and did not go through K&L Gates.
Okay.
But if I may address your comments as a whole,
yes,
Your Honor,
ma'am.
I find your comments offensive. I am an officer of this court. I'm an officer of this court, and I have been involved in a number of criminal trials associated with when I'm a trustee. I understand the need to keep that completely separate. I understand the issues with keeping that separate. I've been accused of providing information in the Meridian case that was considered being, quote, a mole, per se. None of that has ever been proved out. None of that has been ever proved out. The work I was doing for the estate and only for the estate. If I was subsequently asked for it, I would check with my attorney and say, is it something I should provide? And I would get an answer and then act accordingly. But all the work I did and all the work Cascade did was solely for the benefit of the estate. The only way this company was going to be reorganized is if we were successful with resolving the Medallic litigation. There was critical case coming down. We put together a fair amount of information. I think that was a ruse on their part trying to just drive me into bankruptcy, into an insolvent situation. I had to prepare that information to be ready for that trial. We prepared that information to be ready for that trial, and they folded right before the trial. And I find Diane funding their fees offensive also, just driving up the costs in the estate. So no, I'm a fiduciary of this court. I understand my fiduciary responsibilities, have been in a number of criminal cases when I was a trustee, and know the difference and know the separation and appreciate the separation. So no, I find your comments offensive, and I find the blog offensive, because I am not new to this. Contrary to what I said, it's only been 500 and some monthly reports, not 1,000. But I have acted as a trustee in a number of complicated cases with criminal aspects, investigations ongoing at the same time. And I know the difference. And I made sure as I went through my positions, they only asked for items I had already mostly completed or had completed. They were stuff that I had. And yes, I checked with my attorney before I gave them virtually anything. I would send the draft of the subpoena over to my attorney and ask for advice. So as far as I'm concerned, I carried out my fiduciary responsibility to the creditors and to this court.
All right, thank you. Mr. Guerin, if you could file those subpoenas under seal, following the local rule in that process.
We will do that, Your Honor.
Thank you. There's one of the, and as long as we're talking, I'm going to have my courtroom deputy hand up to you a number of emails that were largely on the disk. Let me say what they are. So you provided me, not a disk, a thumb drive, which it wasn't searchable, and because there were 400 individual PDFs, so I had to open each PDF. So the whole document wasn't searchable. I'm not complaining, but I'm just saying, since I got it on Friday rather than last Monday, I didn't have time to get through every single PDF, but I found a bunch of them and I printed a few. And then there are a couple in the stack that you gave that are emails that look a little bit different. And that's because they came from the litigation that the estate had with the Hoffs over the lease assumption. And I'm not saying they weren't on the thumb drive. I just didn't find them. So I'm not accusing you of not including them. I just didn't find them quickly, and I knew where I had them, so I just put them in the pile. What I'd like for you to do is have Mr. Calvert submit a declaration just affirming that these are emails that exchanges that he sent or received, all right? And you don't need to say anything more than that. But rather than having you put every email from the thumb drive in the record, which we don't need, these are the ones that I would like to see in the record. That makes sense?
I understand.
All right, thank you. One of the emails, though, I do want to ask about, it's an email sent in August of 2016 to Mrs. Hoff that says, I have a salesperson who left with all of it and I am suing him in bankruptcy court. What's that about, Mr. Calvert?
David, you want to address that? It's her.
I think I see the email.
Yeah, I think it's the second one from the top.
August 22nd.
Oh, right.
Mother there's Susan's gags, and then there's the other one that was.
You guys want to step outside and talk about this, or?
There's two of these. We're just trying to confirm which one we're dealing with in this email, Your Honor.
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't know what you'd like to know about it, Your Honor, but this actually is Susan Skaggs that I think you heard some discussion about before, and she left the company in a dispute with Mr. Atala.
And with who?
With Mr. Atala.
Oh.
Right, and she went to a competitor, and we actually had analyzed and sort of written a letter to Ms. Skaggs and considered whether we would pursue litigation against Medallic based upon their confidentiality agreement that they
had.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Metalcraft is correct. So she went to work for Metalcraft, and then we investigated whether we had claims that we could pursue against either Ms. Skaggs or against Metalcraft. And at the end of the day, the trustee's analysis was those claims were not claims that could be pursued on an economically viable basis, and we chose not to pursue them.
Well, this email, though, was pretty early on in the case. This is August of 2016. So Bill Atala wasn't on the scene yet.
Oh, then we may have the wrong references.
This says Susan at the bottom of the email. That's why we thought it was the Susan one.
It may very well be
the other one.
Of the same person, but this is also the same person that you ended up using a declaration from in support of a sale motion, if I recall.
That's correct, Your Honor, because she went to Metalcraft.
So
she was still working for the company at that time.
She was working for the second.
No, this may not be the Skaggs. There was a salesperson as well, Your Honor. It may be that we have to look into this.
This is not Susan's gag. This is the lady that was gone at the time I took over and then came. We will pull up the facts on this, Your Honor, but there's actually three.
Three Susans?
No.
Oh.
Four situations where we had concerns where people may have copied customary base or assets of the estate and taken them. And in those different cases, we came out very firm. David, you want to address the one that we sent the letter in?
Well, I think we discussed that one, Your Honor. That was the Barbara Johnson, I believe was her name.
Can you speak into the microphone?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's okay.
I think what Mr. Calvert's referring to, and I know we put you had asked a question about it at a prior hearing.
Right.
Which was there was a time entry from March of 2018, and that was where I drafted a letter to, I believe her name was Barbara Johnson, a cease and desist letter. There was concerns that she may have had customer information.
And let me just say, this is not uncommon in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And so I'm not being critical here, but when I see an email that someone has stolen from the estate and that person will be sued and nothing ever happened, either that person didn't steal anything. So why are you sending an email saying someone stole something if they didn't? And if they did, why hasn't anything happened? I mean, those are the questions this email raises. People stealing stuff or taking stuff in a situation is not uncommon. But when you're going around telling folks, I'm going to sue somebody because they stole stuff, and then you don't do it, what's going on?
Well, sometimes they cease and desist. Sometimes they stop. This particular lady, I remember this one now.
Okay.
This was a lady that left before. I don't remember her name, but we can pull it for you or find it. Left before the bankruptcy. Left because of a disagreement with Ross. And she was out there, and she had a fair amount of sales and a fair amount of book before she left. So I was looking at bringing her back to help grow sales accordingly to some of that customer base. And then when I found out some other things, I chose not to hire her, but then I was concerned about what she had taken before the bankruptcy.
This is Kim, probably. It's not Susan. It looks like Kim. If you go to the there's a second. Go on the other side. These are double sided. Does that help refresh your recollection? Looking for Kim's email.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. That's okay. These are double-sided. I forgot. So that's probably – look, I don't need any more information. I could keep drilling down to various things ad nauseum. I just – that one jumped out at me as a fairly definitive statement that someone has stolen something and that – you were going to pursue it, and I'm just curious as to why it wasn't pursued. At the end of the day, you may decide it's not worth pursuing. I assume that's the case.
What I would have to say to you is there were examples of things filtering through the company, and those were all thoroughly investigated.
Sure.
And any recoveries that we could get, we got, right? And we did evaluate certain claims and chose not to pursue them.
Right.
But I'm going to tell you without any question, Mr. Calvert thoroughly investigated every one of those examples and sought to recover anything he could back to the estate based on those circumstances.
Okay, thank you.
I took it very serious. I had people, including a sheriff and an FBI agent before that was a salesperson, mm-hmm. that took stuff upon leaving. Yeah. And I had to go get him. I had to get the assets back. I got the assets back. I threatened him saying, I'm going to, you know, bankruptcy fraud is bankruptcy fraud. You're an FBI agent. You're a sheriff. And he took the old Titanic, the old 1918 Titanic die. And I caught him on tapes and I pulled him back and I brought it back. So, no, I had Bill Atala come in the middle of the night, picking up stuff. I had to go chase him down. So, no, I carried out my fiduciary job very well and took it very serious if I saw any assets of the estate. And Your Honor, one of the major issues I still have left is I have 10 computers in my office that have all the artwork. And because of your previous rulings associated with who owns that artwork, I'm afraid to do anything with it. And I'm going to ask the court for his advice what to do with this artwork, because I'm still confused what I'm supposed to do with it.
Well, it's not the law that I made up. We'll just have to, you play the cards you dealt with, as you know. We'll deal with that when that comes. All right. I don't need anything more about that email. The last question I have relating though to the emails. Are emails that looks like that came from the Hoffs to Ron Parr and copying Mr. Calvert in November of 2016. And Ron Parr, as you recall, he's from ARM in Utah. And Mr. Hoff writes, I can confirm that on behalf of NWTM that your offer is accepted. He sent a couple of emails with that language, and that jumps out at me as to why Mr. Hoff was acting on behalf of the debtor.
I can answer this very clearly. Early on, Your Honor, I tried to recruit help from the Hoffs. They had certain knowledge, certain expertise, and the like. There was a boneyard out back, and that boneyard out back was something that bothered the Hoffs immensely. There was surplus equipment. Some of it had been cannibalized to keep the operations running. Some of it was stuff that had just been picked up in other auctions and had a certain value. So I had talked to the Hoffs that they know people in the industry. Would you help me find buyers? And Ron Parr was one of those, and Ron Parr was one that knew that everything was subject to bankruptcy court approval. It was just a matter of going through it. So I had discussions with Ron Parr directly after Mr. Hoff had contact with him. And Mr. Hoff's responsibility was trying to figure out the right price. And I have nothing but appreciation for the Hoffs in trying to help me dispose of boneyard equipment for the maximum value possible in a controlled environment. And they did help maximize some of the value. Ron Parr ended up having his own financial difficulties and had a buyer come into his company, so he was not able to perform as he indicated.
I remember that, and that's not your fault.
But anyway,
we had
Mr.
a small
Hoff
trial.
Was very helpful,
but, right?
Helpful finding buyers that could.
Well, I get that, and this has come up a couple of times, but now I have this email that with that language. That language is, I mean, he is not. he is confirming on behalf of the Mint. He didn't work for the Mint. I mean, that's just kind of an odd statement. Did you empower him? Did you authorize him to act on
behalf? I asked him to find me buyers.
And well, this is like him using language that's, it's entirely inappropriate for him to be acting as if he's an agent for the Mint. That's what this language is. And did he just make this up out of whole cloth or?
No, but I ended up having conversations with Ron Parr directly and said to him directly, everything's subject to bankruptcy court approval, but yes, we've accepted your offer and we're pushing it forward.
And were the Hoffs offered any consideration for assisting in these efforts?
I started offering, but they indicated they did not need it. I said everything would be subject to bankruptcy court approval. I do a good job of doing that, caveating things as I go through a case. But yes, I did have discussions with them, and they said, no, we just want the company to be successful. So they got no compensation, and they did not ask for compensation.
That doesn't fit with the narrative that I got from the Hoffs, where their email saying we can't agree to reduce your rent because we need every penny because we're on Social Security. I'm just saying, I'm hearing that now, and I'm thinking all the emails, and I had the Hoffs testified. They seem to be all about the money,
you know.
So are you telling me that they didn't want this money, or they just didn't want to go through the hassle of having to be approved as an employee of the estate?
Your Honor, on the last day down there trying to get sign off on the cleanup of the facility so it could be prepared for sale, the last day with Connie negotiating the last dollars and the agreement and so on, she advised me if she sold, she was going to donate the money to the church that she belongs to. So,
all right,
I can't answer any more than that, but that's what she advised me.
All right, that's fine. I had to raise that given all the emails in which she was just refusing to give you any break on the rent, given that she wanted the money.
Negotiated.
You probably remember that far better than I do.
Very well, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you for answering my questions, Mr. Calvert. I just have a couple of questions for Mr. Guerin. I just want to make sure I understand, because there has been a lot of confusion regarding administrative solvency of the estate. Your declaration is saying that in February 2017, you asserted that you thought the estate was administratively insolvent, even on a liquidation basis.
Administratively solvent.
Was it administratively solvent on a liquidation basis? Sorry if I missed it. Administratively solvent even on a liquidation basis.
I think that's the question you asked,
yes,
me, Your Honor, and I said I think so.
And you now have gone back and you said at that time you did not believe the estate. You believed that to be true, and you didn't have any information that said that it wasn't true.
Correct.
And okay.
To the contrary, I had information that supported, and I think we had discussions to address the issue in advance of the hearing, and I had information that supported that the estate was administratively solvent at that time.
Even on a liquidation basis?
Even on a liquidation basis, although, okay. You know, I think the colloquy we were having, Your Honor, I was telling you I still thought we had an ability to sell the company as a going concern, even though that might be a liquidation. It might be a sale of the company, right?
Well,
on a meltdown basis, yes, right. And I think I gave you the information that we had available to us was the May 2016 analysis the trustee had done and the monthly reports. And, you know, based upon that data, I was reaching the conclusion, yes, the estate was administratively solvent.
And it wasn't until, well, when did you determine that the estate was administratively insolvent on a liquidation basis?
Your Honor, I think we actually had gone back in connection with the fee applications we filed in October of 2017, we went back and we looked at retrospectively, now that we know what these values are, now we know about some additional claims that we may not have known about or may not have been thinking about back in the early 2017 timeframe. I think we did an analysis which suggested that the estate would have been administratively insolvent even earlier than we had thought.
Okay.
But I will tell you that Your Honor, I may have been wrong when I came, I was wrong when I told the court that we all knew that it was administratively insolvent at the very earliest stages of the case. I was wrong about that, but and I've been wrong before. But I've never come into this court and intentionally misrepresented facts to the court or tried to deceive the court. Never.
Well, I mean, it begs the question then, why did you say that in your prepared remarks on December 7, 2018? It wasn't in response to a question. It was your opening statement. And you're saying you were wrong. What were you basing that statement on?
My notes in preparation for that hearing, Your Honor, actually say that the estate was administratively insolvent, not that we knew the estate was administratively insolvent. And so I think that's what I intended to say when I prepared my remarks in advance of the hearing. And that was based upon us our retrospective look as we sit here today looking back, knowing that it is conceivable that the estate was administratively insolvent on a liquidation meltdown basis, given what we know today about values and about claims. But I was mistaken when I said that there was knowledge of that early on in the case, because I've gone back and looked at the correspondence and the communications I had with Mr. Northrup and with Mr. Calvert, and that wasn't the case. We were actually all the way through, I would say, the late fall of 2017, we actually thought we had a viable sale opportunity or reorganization opportunity that would bring a dividend to creditors in the case.
All right, thank you. I won't ask any more questions about that. Finally, in the emails that I got from you regarding your communications with Tom Lerner, there is an email dated May 4, subject Dick Bressler's $9 million claim, which Mr. Lerner says, I think an attempted humor, I was trying to get your attention, which I assume it did. This is attached to your declaration, Mr. Guerin, your second supplemental declaration, docket 2036, and it's near the end. Are you looking for it?
I am.
Okay, so it's your last, exhibit. And
is there a page, Your Honor, by chance?
Well, so it's A53.
We're docket 2036, Your Honor?
2036, yes. And exhibit A, page 53. And A53 is on the bottom left. Do you have this, Mr. Northrup? Do you have this email in front of you, or do you have the?
No, which?
Oh, so this is an email. It's this is attached to Mr. Guerin's declaration, second supplemental declaration, docket 2036, exhibit A, page 53 of exhibit A. It's an email from Tom Lerner to Mike Guerin and Mark Northrup, dated May 4, 2017.
I wouldn't take it.
I have it in front of me.
All right.
I did find it.
All right. And Mr. Northrup, do you have that?
This is the May 4, 2017 at 9:11 a.m.
Yes, 9:11 a.m.
Yes, I do.
Yes. So you can take a second to look at the email. It is interesting. To put it mildly, that Mr. Lerner is threatening to file a $9 million claim, trebling his $3 million investment, even though acknowledging his client received $800,000 back. So I don't know why he would think there'd be any basis to treble $3 million. Ultimately, he did file a $9 million claim, but he's asking for an agreement from, I guess, the Mr. Northrup and Mr. Guerin to a claim for $2,237,000. The last email, the very last page of this exhibit, just says it's an email again from Mr. Lerner to Mr. Northrup and Mr. Guerin dated June 15, saying we're 15 days away from the claims deadline. So I'm just checking in to see if you have a response from your clients. I don't have any further emails from Mr. Guerin. I didn't ask Mr. Northrup to produce his emails, but what was the response to this pretty provocative email?
No.
Okay.
I mean, Your Honor, this was a threat to file a claim, and we never, of course, we weren't going to reach agreement with them on conceding or consenting to a claim. I mean, I think Mr. Lerner was frustrated that the settlement hadn't been approved, and he was, coming back and raising claims that we did not believe were allowable, and we told him that we weren't going to consent or go back to the court to seek approval of another settlement. At that point, I can't say we talked about the settlement. We told him no. We told him we would not agree to object to the claim or to take any other action that he might be requesting he would take with respect to the claim.
Given I already said no once to a settlement, it seemed like a poor idea.
Right.
I gotcha. All right. And Mr. Northrup, you didn't have any separate conversations with Mr. Lerner, I assume?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Okay. I don't even recognize and don't remember getting this email, but it certainly would have been ignored, probably met the same response that it did from Mr. Guerin.
Yeah, it's provocative, to say the least. All right, that's all the questions I have this morning. I did see your supplemental reply, Mr. Guerin, and you're all volunteering to take a reduction. I mean, the reality is you're going to get a reduction whether you volunteer or not, because there's just not that much money, and to pay everybody in full, if should they all be allowed in full. I'm not prepared today to award any compensation. I'm going to carefully consider what has been presented to me. I have an independent duty. Everybody knows I have an independent duty to review fee applications. And it would be very easy for me just to say, let's just do it pro rata, no matter, unless I lock people down by 75%, all the money is going to go to the professionals, 75 or some very large percentage. So what's the point in spending a lot of time and writing any sort of ruling? But I'm not going to take the easy way. I have a duty, I have an obligation to the creditors, to this process, to review the fees, and to any award has to be, I have to make a finding and conclusion that the professionals are entitled to any award or reimbursement. So I need to go through that analysis. And even if at the end of the day, all the money goes to the professionals, I still need to go through that. If the creditors are owed that. I'm supposed to do that even if there are no objections, and there are objections. So I especially have to go through that. So I know that you've waited a long time for payment, and I'm extending this out until I make my ruling, and I don't know if it's going to be oral or written at this time, but the decision was made by the professionals to wait till the end, not make application every 120 days, not ask for the court or to specifically ask the court not to rule on the preliminary fee applications filed in October 2017. So there was a decision to wait until the end, and I'm just have to wait a little bit longer. I know this has been a long time. Professionals have extended a lot of credit to this estate. That's sometimes the nature of the game. This is an unusually difficult case. I think everyone can agree on that. That's all I have this morning.
Could I have one comment, please?
Yes.
And I understand that. I don't think there's any issue about the court taking its time and having a measured and, thoughtful analysis of the award of the fees. I'm going to ask the court, please, to keep in mind that I think in this jurisdiction it's important to recognize the efforts of trustees that undergo very difficult extremely stressful circumstances in the administration of a case. And this is one of those cases. And I think that there already have been significant sacrifices, economic sacrifices, financial sacrifices made by this trustee, putting money back into the bankruptcy estate through his Cascade entity, supporting this through his the payment of his employees. He's going to take an economic loss on this case, regardless of what you award in this case. And I think that the trustee's been subjected to false accusations during the course of this case, multiple false accusations that we proved you through the submissions that we provided to you were false, that these China assets were diverted out of the estate, that computers and valuable software had been transferred to former employees out of the estate. False accusations were made against him. There have been, you've raised issues about reimbursement and reporting issues, and those are blemishes. And I will tell you that I think that there's no question that there are reporting things that we would like to have done otherwise. But I would hope the court would keep in mind the perspective on this. And at some point, the court, I would hope, will recognize the efforts that the trustee put into this case and will express appreciation for what he's had to undergo in the ordeal of dealing with this case. This court asked Mr. Calvert to clean up one of the biggest messes we've had in a Chapter 11 case in this jurisdiction in years, and he has done that. He has administered, effectively, thoroughly administered this case to a conclusion, paying all of the other administrative creditors other than $9,300, which we have asked you again, we'd like to be able to pay. So I hope, I'm asking the court to keep all that in perspective when it makes its ruling regarding the compensation that should be awarded and the comments that should be directed to Mr. Calvert and the professionals in connection with the administration of this case.
All right, thank you, Mr. Guerin. Mr. Northrup, anything you'd like to add?
Your Honor, I'd like to supplement the record in a very small way, but as I was preparing for the hearing this morning and looking at my declaration, Exhibit D contains correspondence between my law firm and the K&L Gates law firm, and I was disturbed to see that my March 13, 2017 email to Mr. Guerin, in which I transmitted to him the letter drafted by William Hansen, was somehow omitted from my Exhibit D, but I wanted to point out to the court that that had previously been filed as Exhibit H to my supplemental declaration, docket number 1979. So it was before the court already, and I apologize for that.
That's all right. As you said, it's already in the record, so and that's been the subject of much discussion, but I appreciate you letting me know that. Mr. Smith, you're sitting in the back. Anything that you'd like to add? All right, thank you. Thank you all very much. All right. We'll be in recess.
All rise.